Blog Talk Radio.
There's a little song that we sing in our movement down in the South. I don't know if you've heard it, but it has become the theme song. We shall overcome. We shall overcome. Deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome. Though I join hands so often with students and others behind jail bars singing it, we shall overcome. Sometimes we've had tears in our eyes when we joined together to sing it, but we still decided to sing it. We shall overcome. No, before this victory is won, some will have to get thrown in jail some more, but we shall overcome. Don't worry about us. Before the victory is won, some of us will lose jobs, but we shall overcome. Before the victory is won, even some will have to face physical death. But if physical death is the price that some must pay to free their children from a permanent psychological death, then nothing shall be more redemptive. We shall overcome. Before the victory is won, some will be misunderstood and called bad names and dismissed as rabble-rousers and agitators. But we shall overcome. And I'll tell you why. We shall overcome because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. We shall overcome because Carlyle is right. No lie can live forever. We shall overcome because William Cullen Bryant is right. Truth crushed to earth will rise again. We shall overcome because James Russell Lowell is right. Truth forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne. Yet that scaffold sways the future. Behind the dim unknown standeth God within the shadow, keeping watch above his own. We shall overcome because the Bible is...
responsibility for everything that Jim Paul does.
of the nation to this whole issue in Selma, Alabama.
We must also realize that the problems of racial injustice and economic injustice cannot be solved without a radical redistribution of political and economic power.
We read one day, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But if a man doesn't have a job or an income, he has neither life nor liberty and the possibility for the pursuit of happiness. He merely exists."
Estimated that we spend $322,000 for each enemy we kill in Vietnam, while we spend in the so-called war on poverty in America only about $53 for each person classified as poor.
The promises of the Great Society have been shot down on the battlefield of Vietnam, making the poor, white and Negro, bear the heaviest burdens both at the front and at home.
The other thing I want you to understand is this, that it didn't cost the nation one penny to integrate lunch counts. It didn't cost the nation one penny to guarantee the right to vote. But now we are dealing with issues that cannot be solved without the nation spending billions of dollars and undergoing a radical redistribution of economic power.
Yes, yes.
All labor has dignity.
Yes.
But you are doing another thing. You are reminding not only Memphis, but you are reminding the nation that it is a crime for people to live in this rich nation and receive starvation wages.
America's opportunity to help bridge the gulf between the haves and the have-nots. And the question is whether America will do it. There's nothing new about poverty. What is new is that we now have the techniques and the resources to get rid of poverty. And the real question is whether we have the will. At the very same time that America refused to give the Negro any land, through an act of Congress, our government was giving away millions of acres of land in the West and the Midwest, which meant that it was willing to undergird its white peasants from Europe with an economic floor. But not only did they give the land, they built land-grant colleges with government money to teach them how to farm. Not only that, they provided county agents to further their expertise in farming. Not only that, they provided low interest rates in order that they could mechanize their farms. Not only that, today many of these people are receiving millions of dollars in federal subsidies not to farm, and they are the very people telling the black man that he ought to lift himself by his own bootstraps. Now, this is what we are faced with, and this is the reality. Now, when we come to Washington in this campaign, we are coming to get our check.
I come here tonight and plead with you. Believe in yourself and believe that you're somebody. As I said to a group last night, nobody else can do this for us. No document
can do this for us. No Lincolnian Emancipation Proclamation can do this for us. No Kennisonian or Johnsonian Civil Rights Bill can do this for us. If the Negro is to be free, he must move down into the inner resources of his own soul and sign with a pen and ink of self-assertive manhood his own Emancipation Proclamation. Don't let anybody take your manhood. Be proud of our heritage. As somebody said earlier tonight, we don't have anything to be ashamed of. Somebody told a lie one day. They couched it in language. They made everything black, ugly, and evil. Look in your dictionary and see the synonyms of the word black. It's always something degrading and low and sinister. Look at the word white. It's always something pure, high, and clean. But I want to get the language right tonight. I want to get the language so right that everybody here will cry out, "Yes, I'm black, I'm proud of it, I'm black and beautiful."
What is the relationship between this and the reality of the Negro masses?
Well, to move on out of it for a moment. Martin's very rare, very great man. Martin's rare.
Of despair. in this America, millions of work-starved men walk the streets daily in search for jobs that do not exist. In this America, millions of people find themselves living in rat-infested, vermin-filled slums. In this America, people are poor as millions. They find themselves perishing on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. Of course, to grow up, involved in priority, farming every day in this mental sky. As we look at this other America, we see it as an arena of blasted hopes and shattered dreams. Many people of various backgrounds live in South America, some are Mexican, some are Puerto Ricans, some are Indians, some happen to be from other groups. Millions of them are African whites. Probably the largest group in this other America in proportion to its size and population is the American Negro. American Negro finds himself living in a triple ghetto. A ghetto of race, a ghetto of poverty, a ghetto is to deal with this problem, to deal with this problem of the poor America. We are seeking to make America one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Now let me say that the struggle of civil rights, the struggle to make peace in America one America, is much more difficult today than it was 5 or 10 years ago. For about a decade, or maybe 12 years. Struggles all across the South, glorious struggles. Get rid of the overt segregation and all of the humiliation that surrounded that system of segregation. And the struggle did not go to a lunch counter and so many instances and get a hamburger or a cup of coffee. We could not make use of public accommodation. But transportation was segregated.
Often we had to sit in the back in transportation. Transportation within cities, we often had to stand over empty seats because sections were reserved for whites only. We did not have the right to vote in so many areas of the South. The struggle was to deal with these problems. Now certainly they were humiliating conditions. By the time we protested these conditions, we made it clear that it was ultimately more honorable to accept jail cell experiences than to accept segregation and humiliation. By the thousands, schools and adults decided to sit in at segregated lunch counters to protest conditions there. When they were sitting at those lunch counters, they were in reality standing up for the best in the American dream, seeking to take the whole nation back to those great wells of democracy, which were dug deep by the founding fathers in the formulation of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. Many things were gained as a result of these years of struggle.
1964, the Civil Rights Bill came into being after the Birmingham Movement, which did a great deal to subpoena the conscience of a large segment of the nation to appear before the judgment seat of morality on the whole question of civil rights. After the Selma Movement in 1965, we waited to get a voting rights bill. All of these things represented strife. But we must see that the struggle today is much more difficult. It's more difficult today because we are struggling now for genuine equality. It's much easier to integrate a lunch counter than it is to guarantee a livable income and a good solid job. It's much easier to guarantee the right to vote than it is to guarantee the right to live in sanitary, decent housing conditions. It is much easier to integrate a public park than it is to make genuine quality integrated education a reality. So today, we are struggling for something which says we demand genuine equality. Not merely a struggle against extremist behavior toward Negroes. I'm convinced that many of our people who supported us in the struggle in the South are not willing to go all the way now. I came to say this in a very difficult and painful way in Chicago, the last year where I lived and worked. Some of the people who came quickly to march in Selma and Birmingham were active around Chicago. I came to see that so many people who supported morally and even financially what we were doing in Birmingham and Selma were arrayed against the extremist behavior of Bull Connor and Jim Clark toward Negroes, rather than believing in genuine equality for Negroes. And I think this is what we've got to see now, and this is what makes the struggle much more difficult. So as a result of this, we see many problems existing today that are growing more difficult. It's something that is often overlooked, but Negroes generally live in worse slums today than 20 or 25 years ago. In the North, schools are more segregated today than they were in 1954 when the Supreme Court's decision on desegregation was rendered. Economically, the Negro is worse off today than he was 15 and 20 years ago. So the unemployment rate among whites at one time was about the same as the unemployment rate among Negroes. But today, the unemployment rate among Negroes is twice that of whites. And the average income of the Negro is today 50% less than whites. As we look at these problems, we see them growing and developing every day. We see the fact that the Negro economically is facing a depression in his everyday life that is more staggering than the depression of the 30s. The unemployment rate, the nation as a whole, is about 4%. Statistics would say from the Labor Department that among Negroes is about 8.4%. These are the persons who are in the labor market, who still go to employment agencies to seek jobs, so they can be calculated. The statistics can be gotten because they are still somehow in the labor market. There are hundreds of thousands of Negroes who have given up. They have lost hope. They come to feel that life is a long and desolate corridor for them to exercise. So they no longer look for a job. There are those who estimate that these persons who are all the disparaged persons, the 6 to 7% in the Negro community, that means unemployment among Negroes may well be 16%. Among Negro youth in some of our urban areas, it goes to 30% and 40%. So you can see what I mean when I say that in the Negro community, that is a major, tragic, and staggering depression that we face in our everyday lives. Now the other thing that we've got to come to see now that many of us didn't see too well during the last 10 years, that is that race is still alive in our own life, much more widespread than we realize. We must see racism for what it is. It is a myth of the superior and the inferior race. It is a false and tragic notion. One particular group, one particular race is responsible for all of the progress, all of the insights, and the total flow of history. And the theory that another race is totally depraved, innately impure, and innately inferior. In the final analysis, racism is evil because its ultimate logic is genocide. Hitler was a sick, tragic man who carried racism to its logical conclusion. He ended up leading nations to the point of killing about 6 million Jews. This is the tragedy of racism because its ultimate logic is genocide. One says, I'm not good enough to live next door to him. One says, I am not good enough to eat at a lunch counter, to have a good, decent job, or to go to school with him, merely because of my race. He is saying, consciously or unconsciously, I do not deserve to exist. To use a philosophical analogy here, racism is not based on some empirical generalization. It is based rather on an ontological affirmation. It is not the assertion that certain people are culturally otherwise because of environmental conditions. It is the affirmation that the very being of a people is inferior. This is the great tragedy of it. I say, for everyone that says it is, we must honestly see and admit racism is still deeply rooted all over America, still deeply rooted in the North, still deeply rooted in the South. This leads me to say something about another discussion that we hear a great deal, and that is the so-called white backlash. I would like to honestly say to you that the white backlash is merely a new name for an old phenomenon. Not something that just came into being because shouts of black power, because Negroes engaged in rioting or anything. The fact is that the state of California voted the entire house and fell out of existence before anybody shouted black power, before anybody rioted in Watts. May well be the shouts of black power and rioting in Watts and the Harlem and the other areas are the consequences of a white backlash, but what it is necessary to see that there has never been a single solid monistic determined commitment on the part of the majority of white Americans on the whole question of civil rights and on the whole question of racial equality. This is something that truth impels all will to admit. It is said on the Statue of Liberty that America is the home of the big bomb. It doesn't take us long to realize that America has been the home of its white exiles from Europe. But it are not events the same kind of maternal care and concern for its black child from Africa. It is no wonder that no one is sorrowful. The Negro sings sometimes, I feel like a bubble of what great estrangement, what great sense of rejection caused the people to emerge with such a metaphor as they look over there. What I'm trying to get across is that our nation has constantly taken a positive step forward on the question of racial justice and racial equality. Over and over again at the same time, it made certain backward steps. And this has been the persistence of the so-called white backlash. In 1863, the Negro was freed from the bondage of physical slavery. But at the same time, the nation refused to give him a hand to make that freedom meaningful. And at that same period, America was giving millions of acres of land in the West and the Midwest, which meant that America was willing to undergird its white peasants from Europe with an economic floor that would make it possible to grow and develop, refused to give that economic floor to its black peasant, so to speak. This is why Frederick Douglass could say that emancipation for the Negro was freedom to hunger, freedom to the winds and rains of heaven, freedom without roofs to cover their heads. He went on to say that it was freedom without bread to eat, freedom without land to cultivate. It was freedom and famine at the same time. But it does not stop there. In 1875, the nation passed a civil rights bill and refused to enforce it. In 1964, the nation passed a weaker civil rights bill. Even to this day, that bill has not been totally enforced at all. The nation heralded a new day of concern for the poor, for poverty-stricken, for the disadvantaged, brought into being a poverty bill. At the same time, it put such little money into the program that it was hardly and still remains hardly a good skirmish against poverty. White politicians in suburbs talked eloquent against open housing, in the same breath contend that they are not racist. All of this, all of these things tell us that America has been backlashing on the whole question of basic constitutional and God-given rights for Negroes and other disadvantaged groups for more than 300 years. So these conditions, persistence of widespread poverty, slums, tragic conditions in schools and other areas of life, all of these things have brought about a great deal of despair, a great deal of desperation, a great deal of disappointment and even bitterness in the Negro communities. They all of our cities confront huge problems. All of our cities are potentially powder keg as a result of the continued existence of these conditions. Many in moments of anger, many in moments of deep bitterness, engage in riots. Let me say, as I've always said, I will always continue to say, that riots are socially destructive and self-defeating. I'm still convinced that nonviolence is the most potent weapon available to oppress people in their struggle for freedom and justice. I feel that violence will only create more social problems than they will solve. That in a real sense it is impractical for the Negro to even think of mounting a violent revolution in the United States. We continue to condemn riots, continue to say to my brothers and sisters that this is not the way, continue to affirm that there is another way. But at the same time, it is as necessary for me to be as vigorous in condemning the conditions which cause persons to feel that they must engage in riot activities as it is for me to condemn life. America must see riots do not develop out of thin air. Certain conditions continue to exist in our society, which must be condemned as vigorous as we condemn riots. In the final analysis, riot is the language of the unheard. What is it that America has failed to hear? Failed to hear that the plight of the Negro poor has worsened over the last few years. Failed to hear that the promises of freedom and justice have not been met. It has failed to hear that large segments of white society are more concerned about tranquility and the status quo, not about the cost of equality and humanity. So on a real sense, our nation summers of riots caused by our nation's winters of delay. As long as America holds on to justice, we stand in the position of having these recurrences of violence and riot over and over again. Social justice and progress are the absolute guarantors of riot. Now let me go on today that if we are to deal with all the problems that I've talked about, if we are to bring America to the point that we have one nation, indivisible with liberty and justice for all, there are certain things that we must do. The job ahead must be massive and positive. We must develop massive action programs all over the United States of America in order to deal with the problems that I have mentioned. Now, in order to develop these massive action programs, we've got to get rid of one or two false notions that continue to exist in our society. One is the notion that only time can solve the problem of racial injustice. I'm sure you heard this idea. It is the notion almost that is something in the very flow of time that will miraculously cure all evils. I've heard this over and over again, and there are those, they are often sincere people who say to Negroes and their allies in the white community that we should slow up and just be nice and patient and continue to pray, and in 100 or 200 years, the problem will work itself out. Because only time can solve the problem. I think that is an answer to that myth. And it is the time. It can be used either constructively or destructively. And I'm absolutely convinced that the forces of ill will in our nation, the extreme right in our nation, have often used time much more effectively than the forces of goodwill. It may well be that we will have to repent in this generation, not merely for the vitriolic words of the bad people and the violent actions of the bad people, but for the appalling silence and indifference of the good people who sit around and say, wait on time. Somewhere we have come to see that social progress never rolls in on the wheels of inevitability. It comes through the tireless efforts and the persistent work of dedicated individuals. And without this hard work, time itself becomes an ally of the primitive forces of social stagnation. So we must help time. We must realize that the time is always right to do right. And that's another notion to get about. It's about
in our country. And I believe in changing the heart. I preach about it. I believe in the need for conversion in many instances and regeneration to a lot of attempts. And I was the first to say that if the race problem in America is to be solved, white person must treat the Negro right, not merely because the law says it, but because it's natural, because it's right, because the Negro is his brother. So I realize that if we are to have a truly integrated society, men and women will have to rise to the majestic heights of being unimportant. That's the saying this, let me say another thing which gives the other side, that is that although it may be true that morality cannot be legislated, behavior can be regulated. But though it may be true that the law cannot change the heart, it can restrain the heart. But though it may be true that the law cannot make a man love me, it can restrain him from listening to me. And I think that's pretty important also. So while the law may not change the hearts of men, it can and it does change the habits of men. When you begin to change the habits of men, pretty soon the attitudes will be changed. Pretty soon the hearts will be changed. I'm convinced that we still need strong civil rights legislation. There's a bill before Congress right now to have a national federal open housing bill. Federal law declaring discrimination in housing unconstitutional. Also a bill to make the administration of justice real all over our country. Now nobody can doubt the need for this. Nobody can doubt the need to think about the fact that since 1963, some 58 Negroes and white civil rights workers have been brutally murdered in the state of Mississippi alone. Not a single person has been convicted for that of the crime. There have been some indictments, but no one has been convicted. So there is a need for the whole question of the administration of justice. There is a need for fair housing laws all over our country. Congress last year allowed this bill to die. That bill died in Congress and this of democracy died. The freedom of justice died. Happened again in this session of Congress. Made a decree of our commitment to democratic principles will die. I can see no more dangerous trend in our country than the Congress developing from the dominance of equal citizens raised by white privilege. So they can fight it so much as that. On the way this problem will be solved by the nation making a strong stand, by state government taking a strong stand against housing segregation and against discrimination in all of these areas. And there's another thing that I'd like to mention as I talk about the Massive Action Program and time of us particularly going to specific programmatic action and race free. But it must be realized now that the Negro cannot solve the problem by himself. There again, there are those who always say to the Negro, why don't you do something for yourself? Why don't you live by your own strength? Is it over and over again? Now, certainly, there are many things that we must do for ourselves that only we can do for ourselves. Certainly, we must develop within a sense of dignity and self-respect that nobody else can give us. And the man
Of the Nobel Prize. contemplation, I conclude that this award which I have received on behalf of that movement is a profound recognition that nonviolence is the answer to the crucial political and moral questions of our time. The need for man to overcome oppression and violence without resorting to violence and oppression. Civilization and violence are antithetical concepts. Negroes of the United States, following the people of India, have demonstrated that nonviolence is not sterile passivity, but a powerful moral force which makes for social transformation. Sooner or later, all the peoples of the world will have to discover a way to live together in peace, and thereby transform this pending cosmic elegy into a creative song of brotherhood. If this is to be achieved, man must evolve for all human conflict a method which rejects revenge, aggression, and retaliation. The foundation of such a method is love. Torturous rope which had led from Montgomery, Alabama to Oslo bears witness to this truth. This is a road over which millions of Negroes are traveling to find a new sense of dignity. This same road has opened for all Americans a new era of progress and hope. It has led to a new civil rights bill. And it will, I am convinced, be widened and lengthened into a superhighway of justice as Negro and white men in increasing numbers create alliances to overcome their common problems. I accept this award today with an abiding faith in America and an audacious faith in the future of mankind. I refuse to accept despair as the final response to the ambiguities of history. I refuse to accept the idea that the isness of man's present nature makes him morally incapable of reaching up for the eternal orderness that forever confronts him. I refuse to accept the idea that man is mere flotsam and jetsam in the river of life, unable to influence the unfolding events which surround him. I refuse to accept the view that mankind is so tragically bound to the starless midnight of racism and war. The bright daybreak of peace and brotherhood can never become a reality. I refuse to accept the cynical notion that nation after nation must spiral down a militaristic stairway into the hell of nuclear annihilation. I believe in unarmed truth and unconditional love will have the final word in reality. This is why right temporarily defeated is stronger than evil triumph. I believe that even amid today's water burst and whining bullets, that is still hope for a brighter tomorrow. I believe that wounded justice, lying prostrate on the blood-flowing streets of our nations, can be lifted from this dust of shame to reign supreme among the children of men. I have the audacity to believe that peoples everywhere can have 3 meals a day for their bodies, education and culture for their minds, and dignity, equality, and freedom for their spirits.
I believe that what self-centered men have torn down, men of other centered can build up. I still believe that one day mankind will bow before the altars of God and be crowned triumphant over war and bloodshed, nonviolent redemptive goodwill, proclaim the rule of the land. The lion and the lamb shall lie down together, and every man shall sit under his own vine and fig tree, and none shall be afraid. I still believe that we shall overcome. This faith can give us courage to face the uncertainties of the future. It will give our tired feet new strength as we continue our forward stride toward the city of freedom. Our days become dreary with low hovering clouds, and our nights become darker than a thousand midnights. We will know that we are living in the creative turmoil of a genuine civilization struggling to be born. Today I come from Oslo as a trustee, inspired and with renewed dedication to humanity. I accept this prize on behalf of all men who love peace and brotherhood. I say I come as a trustee, but in the depths of my heart I'm aware that this prize is much more than an honor to me personally. Every time I take a flight, I am always mindful of the many people who make a successful journey possible. The known problems and the unknown ground crew. You honor the dedicated pilots of our struggle, who have set it for controls as the freedom movement soared into all. You honor once again Chief Luthuli of South Africa, who struggles with and for his people, are still met with the most brutal expression of man's inhumanity to man. You honor the Crown Group, without whose labor and sacrifice the jet flights to freedom never have left the earth. Most of these people will never make the headlines. Their names will never appear in Who's Who. Yet when years have rolled past, when the blazing light of truth is focused on this marvelous age in which we live, men and women will know, and children will be taught, that we have a finer man, a better people, a more noble civilization. Because these humble children of God, we're willing to suffer for righteousness' sake. I think out the Nobel will know what I mean. And I say I accept this award in the spirit of a curator of some precious heirloom, which he holds in trust for its true owners, for all those to whom truth is beauty, and beauty truth, and in whose eyes the beauty of genuine brotherhood, peace, is more precious than diamonds, or silver, or gold. Thank you.